This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, Vice President of Security Technology at Synopsys and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 129th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have with me today Kelly Lum. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Kelly Lum, a.k.a. Aloria, has worked in computer security for 13 years. She's currently a security engineer at Tumblr. Her previous software security experience comes from working in both the government and in the financial services worlds. Kelly's a frequent speaker on the Black Hat SummerCon countermeasure circuit. She also teaches software security as an adjunct professor at NYU, and she lives in Brooklyn. So thanks for joining us today.
Oh, no problem. Pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about your background and your career path first. So did you start out with an interest in security engineering? Or did that come later as you got more into computer security?
So what sort of happened was I was always kind of not a very well-behaved person when it came to computers, back when I was in, high school and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I started to go to school, I just went for general computer science. I always loved programming. I was, messing around with things. Around my junior year, they introduced a scholarship that, in exchange for concentrating in computer security for 2 years, you got a full scholarship, and then you worked for the government.
Oh, sure, through the NSA Centers of Excellence thing.
Right, right.
Yep, I worked on that curriculum, actually.
So I didn't sort of jokingly kind of was like, oh, well, you can only really become a computer security person if you hack into the FBI and then they hire you instead of sending you to jail, which
not
obviously
true.
Was not what I actually believed, but I kind of didn't realize that this was something that was actually an industry and people did it for a living.
Right, right.
This is back in, the early 2000s when security was very, very young.
Sure.
So sort of just my interests sort of developed based on throughout my career path. I started out basically doing research on various network devices and eventually kind of just figured out where my interest lied, and it ended up being more on the application security side, mm-hmm. especially since, I do have that background of, loving to code, loving to build out applications and whatnot.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. One of the things that that I've come across over the years, this was especially true about 5 or 6 years ago, in people who did what you did, they were a little frustrated with the NSA program because the government service part didn't focus for them enough on security engineering, and it overfocused kind of on operations. So they were reasonably good software security people and architects and builders, and then they got stuck managing a bunch of firewalls somewhere, so that really bothered them.
Yeah,
I'm hoping that the NSA has fixed that by now.
Yeah, I kind of lucked out in that mine wasn't, you work for, you get the scholarship and you go work for the NSA. I actually ended up working for the United States Army.
Right, perfect.
So mine was a less, configuring firewalls, operational security, and it's like, here's a whole bunch of IDSs and firewalls and network antivirus. We want you to audit them for security, try to find vulnerabilities, and try to, write proof of concept exploits for them.
Mm-hmm. So that really...
For a few reasons, if you're going to buy a firewall and put it into a, Army network, you want to make sure that you know that it doesn't have, backdoors from whatever country it was produced in.
I believe the name of that country is the United States of America. And the vendor may be Juniper, but we can't really say that on the air, can we?
I know nothing.
So that's interesting. I really like the fact that you started out as a programmer in computer science and then got interested in security sideways. That's the way I think that people in software security or application security should start. I think it's easier to start with a software person. So I have a trick question. I told you there weren't going to be trick questions, but I lied. In your mind, what, if any, is the difference between application security and software security?
I mean, I kind of think that, there's two different approaches to, or there's two sorts of ways that people kind of think of security when it comes to either just a software platform or a specific application you know, wherever your application may be. It may be on a desktop, it may be running on a server, it may be something embedded in a piece of hardware.
Exactly, yeah.
And people tend to think of, oh, I'm, you know, looking at code, I'm, you know, looking for specific exploits and vulnerabilities, but it's not just, you know, the analysis of the code or the analysis of the application. You also, if you, you know, and that is one part of it, and that is one way to see how well the application or system has been engineered, but in terms of, I guess it comes out down to what are you trying to do? Are you just trying to find exploits that, you know, you can use to prove something or sell to a bug bounty or use for nefarious purposes, or are you actually trying to build out a piece of secure software?
Okay, so you think software security is the latter or application security? I mean, look, so here there's no real answer to that question.
Yeah.
I mean, but in my view, when you talk about application security, it tends to be because you came at security through the OSI stack and you just sort of wandered your way up to level 7 and you go, oh, layer 7's called the application layer. Let's call this application security. But if you're a software guy, you're just like, dude, it's software. You know, you thought it was a car, but it's actually software. You thought it was a thermometer or a thermostat. It's actually software.
Yeah, I tend to look at it from that latter viewpoint where, I mean, especially because I was coming from software and I tend to think of applications more in terms of what was the developer thinking or what was the team that designed this out.
Or a web application, say, you know, which is a common usage of that term.
Right. But, you know, there are applications running on your firewalls, as obviously became quite familiar with my first job out of school.
Absolutely right. You know, your firewall is a piece of software, frankly. I remember when we built our first firewall in 1996 out of Marcus Raynham's firewall toolkit at Sigital. We were called Reliable Software Technologies back then, and we called it Big Brother. And then we had little sister. I think we still got little sister, don't we? Yeah, my systems guy, who's also the recording engineer, is saying it's still called that.
Oh, no.
It's not the same box. Don't worry. Now it's like some sort of commercial thingy, probably Checkpoint.
That's a good way to instill confidence.
Well, I mean, that shows you the difference between, say, operational computer security and the kind of stuff that you do and I do.
Right.
So how much of what you do all day at Tumblr as a security engineer is taught in school?
I would say... and I don't really want to sound like I'm self-promoting, but I teach application security at NYU. Mm-hmm. And what I've been teaching is a combination of, oh, yeah, everyone wants to learn how to be a hacker. Everybody wants to learn how to find vulnerabilities and write exploits. But also you need to kind of understand it from, you know, how to securely design it, how to come up with the right requirements.
Yeah, it's a mix. It has to be
right.
A mix.
It has to be a mix. If you're especially when you're working for a company that is producing, it's producing an application, right? It's producing a web app. It's producing a mobile app. It's producing an API. So you know, it's not just sitting down and auditing code and pen testing all day. It's sitting down with the developers, looking through. Architecture plans, doing architecture reviews. Mm-hmm. Now we have like RFCs where they talk about the way we want to design things, and it's back and forth rather than us lecturing them in a meeting.
Great.
So it has to be both, and I also think that, or at least what I found more effective is instead of just kind of getting people, you know, focusing on the soft stuff, such as, you know, the secure development lifecycle, mixing it in with the stuff that I think a lot of students are, that tend to be like, you know, this is what they think computer security is.
Yeah, how to build an exploit, how to find a thing with testing, and so on.
And just sort of use that as a carrot to kind of like get them to look at the other stuff as well.
Yeah, you have to look at the other stuff if you're going to move an army of 10,000 people. And, you know, that's large-scale security engineering looks like that when you're changing the development culture.
Yeah, and it also helps from the other side, too. You know, when we, and this is not just for Tumblr, but this is for other organizations where maybe the developers do kind of think of things in terms more of the SDLC mm-hmm. to get them in a room, maybe have like a capture the flag and whatnot, so that they actually say, hey, there's a cool component of this, too. There's something I can actually, you yeah. know, it's not this mystified, you sure. know, ephemeral thing that, you know, hacking is an art that, you know, you're like a airbender. You're either born with it or you're not.
No, it turns out that all code is shitty and all you got to do is figure out how to tickle it right. So,
right.
So, you know, Mike Howard used to do that at Microsoft. They called them bug bashes, and they mostly just involved a lot of pizza and people breaking stuff instead of testing stuff not to break. They were trying to crash their own code. And I agree with you that hands-on stuff like that is not only exciting, but it's also essential, because if you look at, say, what the government does in the name of software security, it often just amounts to a bunch of bureaucratic box checking that's just BS.
Right. And there have been roles that I've been in where it tended to lean more towards that than the other thing.
Gotcha.
And I kind of feel like even if, you know, those jobs are necessary, especially if you're working in an industry where you do have regulations that you have to comply with.
I guess you're way nicer than I am.
But I also feel that, and this is not just true for that side of things, but also for my side of things, is you got to kind of change, you know, you got to kind of break yourself out of your routine every once in a while and look at things differently and go mm-hmm. from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. That way you don't, like, get that one part of your brain. It would be like if you always, you know, worked on your arms and now you have time, like you skip leg day.
That's a hilarious analogy. So you end up looking like Popeye. My God.
right.
So software engineering is Popeye. So compare and contrast working for the government in the Army, I guess, and working in the financial services sector from the perspective of being a geek like us.
It was sort of interesting. I don't want to say they were a completely different world, just because I had a very niche part of the government, and I know there's other parts that may be more closely or more contrast with it, but it was definitely a, I wouldn't say culture shock, but just a completely new kind of, things move fast. Things mm-hmm. have to move extremely fast. You're mm-hmm. making money. You get something out, even if it's, we're not talking about a week late. If you get it out like 2 hours late, it could greatly, drastically impact your revenue or impact the reputation of, you know, whatever product or whatever thing that, you know, we've seen this, that, you know, a stock IPO ends up being delayed for, you know, it's supposed to come out at 10 a.m. and it ends up coming out at noon.
I have a friend who was an early Java programmer at Morgan Stanley in like 1997, and he wrote an algorithm to compute a second derivative faster than the other people had written an algorithm to do, and it made the firm just millions and millions of dollars, even though all it was a simple math calculation.
Yeah.
And they made him like, they were like, now you're a distinguished engineer. You can do whatever you want. You don't even have to work anymore.
Yeah. And then on the flip side of the coin, we see things like, and this was before I started working in finance, but we saw things like the flash crash where, you know, we have these micro trading things that are working on fractions and fractions of a second, and something goes wrong for, I don't know, a second, 3 seconds, and all of a sudden everyone's like, why?
Yeah, guess how many picoseconds 3 seconds is? 3 billion.
Right.
More than four. So
it's definitely a much faster moving world, and it's also, you know, it's also a world where you have to make a lot of more justification for what you're spending your money on. You can't just run out and say, hey, we're going to spend, you know, $3 million on some new firewalls or something.
Yeah, and even though those guys are regulated, I mean, they're still trying to make money. So the regulatory stuff often turns out to just be an impediment. And if you do what you're doing to build stuff right and the regulatory stuff gets filed automatically in that drawer that you open when the OCC shows up, you're in much better shape than if you're just, you know, box checking and not actually doing it right. So I think that a lot of the financial services industry has moved in that direction.
Yeah, and you really have to sell yourself as, I know that this is not a cost center, we're not making you money, you know, the same way like your core business is, but we're in the business of making it so that you don't lose money
right.
in the long term. It's
well,
sort
I
of
hate
like,
to tell you,
like,
but it is actually a cost center, but it doesn't
yeah,
have a P&L.
It's the same way that, you know, I hate paying homeowner's insurance every month, but right. if my condo ever burns down, you know, I'm going to be a lot happier that I had it.
We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, make sure to check out my other projects on GaryMcGraw.com. There you can find writings, videos, and even original music. Let's move on to another topic. In my view, having helped with the tech transfer from science land to the real world, code review technology has come a long way since 2003. So what's your view on that?
So I kind of have mixed views on this. I think that that sort of the more automated stuff, the thing you check it in, it scans it. I do from a helping out an engineering perspective. If you have that stuff really nailed down and are giving them useful information, mm-hmm. then it's great for developers. It's great that they don't have to wait for somebody to manually check every little PR that they are, you know, merging.
Mm-hmm.
But the keywords there are giving them useful information.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely right. You're right on the money.
You know, you can't just say, "Oh, yeah, we got a source code scanner." It's really we spent a lot of money
and
on it.
You say, "Look, there's a problem in your Java somewhere," and they look at you like, "What the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
It's all Java."
and lots of times it's with some of the products that I've seen. It's like it's not a problem in your Java. It's here are 20 things that you need to look at.
Yeah, and some of them are not true. So
yeah
so you gotta tune that stuff. Absolutely right. And I think one of the big problems in the industry as a whole, especially when it comes to the application security side of the house and the tools, we tend to overfocus on finding bugs without telling anybody how to fix them.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of it is very that sort of. You know, we found something, this is your problem, you have to take care of it, is mm-hmm. kind of why a lot of developers really, really despise security.
Of course, it's because, you know, you make fun of their ugly baby, and nobody, I got to tell you one thing I've learned over the years, do not tell a mother her baby's ugly, even if
right.
it is. Just don't do that.
That's one of the sort of refreshing things about, and again, like it's not, oh, Tumblr's the best thing in the world, and we're the only ones doing it right, but it's one of the things that I find more refreshing here
yeah.
is, you find a security problem, you know, you either go to the developer and say, you know, this is an issue and here's how to fix it, or let me
let's figure it out. Exactly, yeah.
Rather than, I found a problem, assign a ticket, I don't have to think about it anymore until you triage.
Yeah, I understand. We should get you guys into the BSIM. I think you'd be an interesting member to add to that mix.
All right.
So what kind of things do you think code review tools should do today that they don't? And, you know, that includes, say, reviewing dynamic languages like JavaScript and Ruby and whatever.
I would like to see, and we don't actually use any commercial tools. We actually have built in-house our own tools at Tumblr, which I think, which I guess is kind of leading into the answer to your question, is rather than having something, you know, you dump it in and then you try to fine-tune it based on the available rule sets or whatnot, I'd mm-hmm. like to see a little something that is a little bit more
tailored, like set to somebody's production code standards or whatever.
Yeah. Or, you know, like when I go out and I use analogies all the time. When I go out and buy a car, right, there's some car lots you can go into and they're like, you have Model A, Model B, Model C, and this one maybe you can get, like, heaters on the seat. Or if I go to a different car dealership, they're like, all right, you can get these wheels, you can get this
right.
type of transmission, you have three different types of transmission, you can get 5-speed, 6-speed speed, you can get, you know, automatic. I want, like, more modular
yeah.
things. So I want this widget, I want this widget, I want this widget, and then I don't need these other ones.
That's right. So, yeah, I mean, some of the stuff we tried to design so you could turn rules off, but they did, all of the early engines became fairly monolithic. There's
right.
a new set of tech that is integrated into IDEs that's much lighter weight. But of course, you can't do data flow analysis properly inside the IDE, so you get more false positives. So you only look for certain kinds of errors that way, and you have to look for others at build. But I think the tech is coming along. I think everyone should use it. It's totally fine if you roll your own. I don't think that's a problem. But I do think it's a problem if you don't use any code review stuff at all.
Yeah. And I also like to see more correlation between, okay, let's look at what sort of, you know, errors are spewing from our logs. Let's maybe run some of this, you know, our JavaScript or whatever through a headless browser.
That works for your situation. I wouldn't do it for a nuclear power plant that way.
Oh, no.
I mean, that's one of the problems. So automation's totally great, but this, you know, sec DevOps or DevOps sec or sec EOPSI Devi or whatever you want to call it seems to overlook design review a bunch. Mm-hmm. And you said this before, you also have to focus some attention on design while you're thinking the thing up.
Right.
And so I've made this distinction for years between bugs and flaws. I assume you agree with that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the issues is, what do we do about flaws? Because we can't really automate that yet. We don't know how.
No. And, you know, it's one thing to scan some code and say, all right, you're not sanitizing something. It's another thing to say, this thing has been architected so that your authentication has, you know, a very, you know, in the right conditions, there's a bypass.
Or you forgot about an attacker in the middle attack, or you don't have a nonce for freshness, and so you're susceptible to replay or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things. All right, let's switch gears once more. In your talks, you've described DLP, which for those who don't know is data loss prevention tech, as keeping honest people honest. And so I'm wondering, is that good or is that bad?
So I guess it depends on, it also depends on whom you're trying to keep honest, right? If you're trying to prevent maybe somebody who deals with a lot of data but may not be the most, you know, technically proficient, or may not kind of understand the difference between trust levels and whatnot, you're mm-hmm. preventing somebody from copying and pasting something from a classified document into an email.
Mm-hmm. I just run it on your own server. Who cares?
No, I mean, I've seen, and, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people who work with data that isn't supposed to be in places, you know, somebody sends it, somebody emails it to themselves so that they can work on it on their home computer.
Yeah, like Mike Flynn.
Or, you know, somebody prints it out so that they can read it on the train and then leaves it on the train seat. You know, I think that those scenarios are great.
So that sounds like it's kind of like, you know, herding the sheep, but you can't really herd wolves. So
right.
If you're buying DLP to herd sheep, good. And if you're buying it to herd wolves, don't buy it. Is that what you're saying?
I would say, you know, if you have sheep and wolves, don't expect it to protect against them.
Ah, very nice. That's well put. If you have sheep and wolves together, you're a very poor shepherd, by the way, just for the record.
Right.
As a farmer, I can tell you that's a bad idea.
Yeah, sometimes you don't know the wolf's there until you get them.
Oh, exactly. They might wear sheep's clothing or something like that. So how much security tech do you think in operations land relies on that kind of, well, we're just going to make the sheep do the right thing philosophy?
I mean, I'm always kind of reticent to say things like this, but whatever. I feel that a lot of times these solutions, especially like DLP, you know, they do have, you know, their places. They have situations in which they, you know, are good at doing whatever they're supposed to do. But mm-hmm. I also think that there is a misconception, and maybe this is a lot of times on not really on the fault of the person who buys it, but the person who is selling it, to kind of overplay it for having more capacity
of course.
For being able to solve more problems than either it's capable of, or maybe in some person's perspective, it could be capable of solving it, but it's really not a reasonable kind of.
Yeah, those are called salespeople, and we need to have some, and they sell stuff.
Right.
So here's one of the problems I've come across, especially in my work as an advisor to outside firms. There was this firm called Authentica a long time ago, and they got bought by EMC eventually. But they built this great technology sort of for DLP. And, you know, the tech people built this great stuff that requires real policy and what you might call glob tagging in some way to work. But nobody either has the policy or the time to develop the globs, like to figure out what should be classified and what shouldn't be. So the tech people build this kind of empty container that could do some great protection stuff, but nobody knows how to fill the containers up.
Yeah, and that's another thing that I kind of, while you just start talking, that another point that is, I think, significant to make is we're still in a stage of, or a phase in security where we have a lot of very intelligent, very talented people, but the ones who end up, you know, but it's not something like across the board. You know, there we have people who are making purchasing decisions or people who may be in a sort of more, a less mature
organization.
Yeah. Organization. Yeah. And so they don't really have the tools or they don't have the information to make an educated choice about something.
Right. They just make it based on what the sales guy tells them.
Right.
Or salesperson.
And that's not really, I wouldn't put the blame on them completely, because if all the information that, if you're not educated on this, you know, independently, and all the information you're getting is from different sales vendors, then you're really just kind of
lost.
Deciding,
yes.
Yeah, you're deciding, yeah. Between McDonald's and Wendy's.
Yeah, right. And you're trying to have a healthy diet, and
right.
There's your decision. Oops. Yeah, very good. I like that analogy. So now I got a question that's a little difficult, and it's a completely different topic. So your honesty as a successful functioning human who's battling mental illness is absolutely inspiring. And I'm wondering whether you think there are any benefits to your own diagnosis that kind of like a la fire on the brain that come from that are unique and useful in the field.
I think that I don't want to kind of perpetuate, or there is sort of a stereotype of sort of like the brilliant, you know, artist or struggling artist with a mental illness, and I wouldn't want to like romanticize it, but I do think that just because I have had this problem for a very long time, as long as I, you know, I wouldn't say as long as I can remember, but from a very early age, it has forced me to be very analytical. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you're having a thought or you're in a mood, in order to, you know, survive, even, you have to analyze, why am I feeling this way? Why am I thinking this thought? Is this thought true? Mm-hmm. Is this a realistic thing that I'm thinking?
You kind of go meta on it automatically.
Right. And I think that because I've had to always be analytical of myself and just sort of very investigatory, mm-hmm. About my own thinking processes, I think that has sort of made it a little less difficult for me to, you know, kind of do that same thing, which is obviously very essential for computer security.
Yeah, interesting.
You have to analyze things. You have to kind of, you know, say, why was this done, or what was the thought process behind this? Is this normal? Is this, you know, is there an alternate way of approaching this problem?
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that, you know, because I always kind of in my own head and running around, that it's easy for me to kind of spin that sort of process, you know, on external things as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I do want to say that, you know, in all seriousness, your honesty and openness is going to be hugely helpful to a lot of people. So kudos for that. That's fantastic.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, when I first did it, it was mostly like just, you know, frustrated because there didn't seem a lot of other people talking about it, and I'm like, well, why don't I just talk about it? Mm-hmm. And I really have, you know, it's almost selfish, but I really do get a lot of people, you know, asking me for advice and just, you know, kind of giving that all the rest of that sort of sentiment of, you know, thank you. I really benefited from this.
Yeah, so you know what that's called? There's a word for it. It's called leadership. Seriously. So one last question. You have some really great travel picks on your blog, And I don't know if you know, but I also blog about travel too. I have this identity, No Plastic Showers, which is not too secret, but it's a different identity. And so I'm interested to know, what's your favorite part of Helsinki? What did you like most about visiting Helsinki?
Oh man, there's so many different things. I just really liked the one, everything about that area, not just Helsinki in general, but also I also took some time in to go over to Estonia, and everything about just the old architecture versus the new architecture, the beautiful, the people were so nice, and it's not like a sort of the niceness that I tend to see when I travel around America. It's sort of a very cordial, not overly warm, which kind of freaks me out. But
just, you know, you know why that is? It's just because you can freeze to death if you get lost in Finland. Yeah. So people have to be slightly standoffish and also nice enough to not let you die.
Yeah, and I think the biggest highlight of my trip was it was New Year's Eve, and I was worried because I didn't, you know, make a reservation anywhere. I was worried about getting a table.
Yeah.
So I was just wandering around, and I saw this one little place that looked kind of cozy, very traditional Finland restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I go in, and I'm like, listen, feel free to kick me out, but is there any like tiny little corner you can put me in? They're like, actually, yeah, there's this one corner where there's only one seat and a table, and we never get anybody to sit there because people always come in large groups. They're like, you got it. And perfect. I had a wonderful reindeer filet.
Cool. I know exactly which restaurant you're talking about, by the way.
Because Santa never brings me what I want, so. Uh-huh. So reindeer filet, and then I also had a little, I actually tried bear for the first time.
Awesome.
And I'm always about trying the weird meats, so.
Well, cool. Traveling is important, so I'm with you on that as a really nice strategy for dealing with modern life.
Yeah, just get away and get a completely new perspective on things.
Well, thanks for your time today. It's been really interesting talking to you.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me again. Or again, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The November-December issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is devoted to real-world crypto. The issue also features our interview with Jim Manico, though frankly, that one's more fun to listen to because Jim's Jim. Find all of the Silver Bullet episodes on GaryMcGraw.com under the heading Tech. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.